Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A century ago this year, Anne of Green Gables was born, published as the Victorian era passed, when Teddy Roosevelt was president and Ford's Model T was just coming out. It was the tale of an irrepressible young red-headed orphan growing up in a stern Calvinist town on rural Prince Edward Island in Canada. To this day, that Anne of Green Gables has a world of passionate fans, books, films, and TV spin-offs. We've come a long way from the late Victorian days, when just getting an education took a lot of grit in a young woman. And yet, Anne Shirley still speaks to us. Why? This hour on Point, Anne of Green Gables at 100 and still going strong. You can join the conversation. Have you read it? Fallen in love with it? Read it again? Why? Of all the books and characters in all the world, why has this one lasted? Joining me now from Guelph in Ontario, Canada, is Mary Henley Rubio. She is a scholar of Lucy Maud Montgomery, the author of Anne of Green Gables, and literary advisor to the author's estate. Her forthcoming 700-page biography of L.M. Montgomery is called Lucy Maud Montgomery, The Gift of Wings. Mary Henley Rubio, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom, for inviting me.
We just play the music and talk about Anne of Green Gables, and already I've got treacle dripping off the ceiling, but maybe we shouldn't. I mean, the music is all sweetness, but there's a lot of spice and spike in this character that's been so beloved over this century as well, isn't there?
Yes, very much so. And it wasn't a book that was written for children. It was a book that was written for adults. But there is something in it for every age level and for every country.
What's your explanation of why this one, of all the books that came out in 1906 or 7 or 8 or 9, why has this one had such staying power?
Well, I think it's because Montgomery understood human nature so well. She understood people's motivations, their quirks. She is so good at drawing characters and getting them interacting with each other. But that's only one reason. Another reason is that she was a master at storytelling. She was raised in the oral tradition, the Scottish oral tradition of Prince Edward Island, Canada, and she just knows how to tell a story. She also picks themes that everybody relates to, finding your place in the world, negotiating tough situations, getting what you want. And although her characters are very ordinary rural folk, they have the same problems and desires and that everybody every place has.
I'm going to ask you to introduce us to Anne, but before we do, let's just get a little bit of sense of the book. And this is very early in Anne of Green Gables, before Anne herself has actually even appeared on the scene. Just to get a sense of the tone, here's a description of Mrs. Rachel Lynde, I guess, the town tattler, respected and feared as she keeps a watchful eye on everybody in Avonlea. The voice here is that of actress Kate Burton.
Since Avonlea occupied a little triangular peninsula jutting out into the Gulf of St. Lawrence, with water on two sides of it, anybody who went out of it or into it had to pass over that hill road and so run the unseen gauntlet of Mrs. Rachel's all-seeing eye. She was sitting there one afternoon in early June. The sun was coming in at the window warm and bright. The orchard on the slope below the house was in a bridal flush of pinky-white bloom, hummed over by a myriad of bees. Thomas Lynde, a meek little man whom Avonlea people called Rachel Lynde's husband, was sowing his late turnip seed on the hill field beyond the barn.
And the neighbors are about to pick up an orphan boy who they've agreed to take to help them out on the farm. Only it turns out it's not a boy. It's a girl. It's Anne Shirley who's waiting at the train station. Mary Henley Rubio, could you just give us a quick sketch of this girl who lies behind and becomes a woman in this book and those that followed?
Well, she's a free spirit. She we actually hear her parentage. She's the children of two school teachers, but she is a very imaginative child. She has red hair, which is a tip-off to the fact that she's going to be very hard to manage. She talks all the time. Matthew Cuthbert, who picks her up, is a very shy man, and she is just talks constantly all the way home, naming things, imagining things. Then when she meets Marilla, who believes that children should be seen and not heard, she continues talking nonstop and shocks Marilla. She's basically the child that Ella Montgomery herself was when she was little, a very talkative, imaginative, sort of hard-to-manage child who had to be trained into the proper behavior for very staid Avonlea.
There's this funny line from the New York Times Review all the way back in 1908 where they call the book altogether too queer. They, in 1996, they ate their words on that, did a roundup of wrong-headed reviews, and the title was Oops. But was there something about this character or the way this book was presented in those years that was different, odd, queer to readers' eyes generally? And it was a bestseller quickly, but clearly there was something that hit at least one reviewer as outside the mainstream.
It's the writing. It's just because Montgomery is such a lively writer. She has such a wonderful sense of humor. Everything in her novels comes straight out of her life, her emotions, her perceptions, her reading. She was extremely well-read, and her books are full of literary allusions. But she just had such a wonderful sense of humor. She kept the story moving along. She created wonderful characters. She put them in situations where everybody could respond to them. And not only children, but women and men of state and she was just a good writer.
You say it wasn't.
Anybody could write a story about, there were many stories about orphans, but they weren't as good as hers, and they haven't lasted.
It wasn't a story for children, or in particular for children, but who did read it at that time? Did adults pick this up? And these days, it kind of has that reputation, but then?
Yeah. It was marketed with a Gibson girl on the front, and it was marketed for the general reading public. It was read by Mark Twain, who praised it in 1908. It was read by Earl Grey, the Governor General of Canada, who was a very experienced diplomat, very literate diplomat, who came from England. He made a special point of going out to Prince Edward Island to meet Montgomery because he admired the book so much, and he told her that everyone in Britain had already read it because it had been published in Britain by a British publisher in 1908, too. It was read by the two prime ministers of Britain. One in 1927 made a special point to meet her, and that was Stanley Baldwin. He came to Toronto and met her, and then it was read by his successor, who said he read, Ramsay MacDonald, who said he read every Ella Montgomery book that he could possibly get his hands on.
And there were lots and lots of them, and lots more vehicles for Anne. So, Phenom, right from the start, we're talking with Mary Henley Rubio, the biographer of Lucy Maud Montgomery, author of Anne of Green Gables, and of course, readers all around the world. Let's begin to turn to some who might know. Clark calling from Salt Lake City, Utah. Clark, you're on the air. What do you know?
Hello, Tom. I have a farm on Prince Edward Island that we go to in the summer.
Lucky you.
And we just got back day before yesterday. I just wanted to point out two things. First of all, the musical, Anne of Green Gables, that plays in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, is the world's longest-running musical.
Wow.
And secondly, one of the reasons that Anne of Green Gables is so popular, I've heard, is that it's used as an elementary school textbook in Japan. So what you see walking around the streets of Prince Edward Island are lots and lots of Japanese tourists, particularly young girls, young teenage girls, wearing an Anne of Green Gables straw hat with the red pigtails poking out from underneath.
Attached to it, yeah.
as they're, and of course the Japanese girls, and this is a startling sight, to say the least, when you walk around a Canadian province with a lot of red-haired little Japanese girls.
Clark, have you read it yourself or just seen the fans in their masses on Prince Edward Island?
You know, I haven't ever read it myself. I'm not much for that kind of book, I have to say.
Yeah, but,
I haven't even been to the play, in fact.
Wow, you've got the strong resistance, but you've seen the footprint, and it's a big one. I mean, this isn't just a bestseller for many years, Mary Hanley Rubio. This is an economic pillar of a chunk of Prince Edward Island, the tourism that comes with it.
And the result of Ella Montgomery's journals being published between 1985 and 2004 is that she's now being seen as one of the 20th century's greatest female diarists, and she was not respected as a literary figure mm-hmm. through the modernist period, but when feminism came in and started recovering women's writers, she is one who has been recovered fully and is now seen as a worldwide influence through her books because they are read all over the world.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Anne of Green Gables at 100, classic tale of the willful redheaded girl growing up and growing out of the Victorian era, now a century old and still going strong. Mary Hanley Rubio is with us. She's author of the forthcoming biography, Lucy Maud Montgomery, The Gift of Wings. In just a moment, we'll be joined by Kevin Sullivan, director and producer of the 1985 film of Anne of Green Gables. Let's hear just a little more from that famous and now century-old book, Marilla and Matthew Cuthbert. Let it be known they're going to adopt a boy. They thought they were getting a boy who would help on their farm. Their neighbor here again, Mrs. Rachel Lynde, she was horrified.
"Well, I hope it will turn out all right," said Mrs. Rachel in a tone that plainly indicated her painful doubts. "Only don't say I didn't warn you if he burns Green Gables down or puts strychnine in the well. I heard of a case over in New Brunswick where an orphan asylum child did that, and the whole family died in fearful agonies. Only it was a girl in that instance." "Well, we're not getting a girl," said Marilla, as if poisoning wells were a purely feminine accomplishment.
A couple of pages later, Anne shows up, the orphan, a girl, not boy, on the train station platform. Here's a moment from the opening of Kevin Sullivan's 1985 film, Anne of Green Gables, with Anne wandering through the woods slowly on her way to her chores after reading Alfred Tennyson's poem, The Lady of Shalott.
"She knows not what the curse may be, and so she weaveth steadily. Little other care has she, the Lady of Shalott."
"Anne! Anne! Coming, Mrs. Hammond!"
Director and producer of the 1985 film version of Anne of Green Gables and its two sequels, and now, coming out soon, the prequel, Anne of Green Gables, A New Beginning, joins us now from Toronto, Canada. Kevin Sullivan, welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me, Tom.
Did you know you had a winner in Canada picking up this book? Does it have that weight and place in Canadian minds just to begin with? Or was it, I don't know, was it frightening to take a kind of, at this point, Canadian classic and be responsible for turning it into a film?
Well, oddly enough, I was approached by an American company to produce it originally. But it was certainly a Canadian classic that everyone growing up in my day was aware of. And the film version of it that I ultimately created was done primarily for television as a miniseries and ultimately ended up being produced between CBC and PBS. When I was commissioned with the role of interpreting the book onto the screen, though, I don't think I was aware of what the potential impact of it was long term, partly because a film is a very different medium than a book. The book was extremely popular, but I had no idea how audiences would receive the film.
It got picked up and played all over. How did fans of the book respond? Was this a kind of a, I don't know what to compare it to, you know, Harry Potter, they had to be very literal in their movie interpretation. Lord of the Rings, some liberties. Where did you come down?
Well, I think audiences who were familiar with the book had an expectation about it. They obviously had expectations about how Anne would be interpreted and what the visual style of the film would be. Those were things that I did not understand when I embarked on translating the book. But over the course of turning the book into a screenplay and translating it on screen, it began to kind of have a life of its own. And I think at the end of the day, the best course that one can take in trying to reinterpret a book in a film is to digest it thoroughly and then retell the story in your own way. You'll notice that the opening that you just played really had Anne reading The Lady of Shalott, one of Tennyson's poems. That was a quintessential part of her character, but it certainly wasn't where the book started. So there was never any intention to diverge from the book, more to digest it and reinterpret it so that the audience would imagine that they were actually seeing the book on screen.
Mary Hanley Rubio, you mentioned Mark Twain having read it back soon after its publication. In of course, it's a worldwide classic at this point, I think translated into 30-some languages, but in Canada, is it seen as
language.
30? Okay, is it
34.
Seen 34? Is it seen as an equivalent to Tom Sawyer? Is it seen in that vein at all, or is something quite different?
Well, it depends when what time period you're talking about. Up until the mid 80s, when we published the journals, it was talked about as a sentimental novel which had no literary status whatsoever. After the journals came out and people found that Montgomery had a very complex and a rather unhappy personal life, they thought, well, if she is unhappy in her personal life, how did she write these happy, happy novels? And people went back and looked at them again, and this was the time when the feminism, women were reclaiming writers, and that's the point at which she got recovered. And this is the point at which I had been teaching American literature at Guelph. I taught Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer. And this is the point at which I first read Anne of Green Gables, because I was raised in the States in a rural area and didn't have libraries, didn't have access to it. I was just overwhelmed by Anne of Green Gables, and not just because I had red hair like Anne did, and not because I had grown up in a Presbyterian, you know, sort of atmosphere such as she had, and not because, well, one interesting little thing is my mother was born 30 years to the day after Montgomery.
Whoa.
But anyway, I thought, why is this book not regarded as highly as Huck Finn? It is every bit as good, but it's written from a woman's point of view. And at the end, a young woman has to settle down and think about getting married. And this is what you expect is going to happen through the novel. But at the end, Montgomery doesn't have that in mind for Anne. She has her sit at the open window and look at the bend in the road. And you know that even though Anne is going to do what is expected, stay home with Marilla because Matthew has died, the bend in the road is there and Anne is going to light out when the time comes.
Huck Finn is given that stature finally because of the way it deals with race and racism in American, U.S. culture. Are you saying that the ballast in Anne of Green Gables comes from the handling of gender roles and women's position? Is that the equivalency?
Yeah, I think it is, because what Montgomery is an extremely subversive writer. She says on one level what you all the conservative society, including her conservative society, wanted to hear, which is the only thing that's ahead for girls is getting married. That, of course, is not same now, but she says what conservative society wants to hear, and then she turns around and shows how much fun it is to buck the social norms. And this is done by Anne bringing imagination and everything into Avonlea. But the point is, she is really concerned with how women are treated, and what Anne says when she realizes that the Cuthberts had expected a boy and got a girl, is that you don't want me because I'm not a boy. And that is Montgomery's cry from the heart. She realized that if she had been a boy, as smart as she was, she would have been given the best education. Because she was a girl, her whole family just expected her to get married and never be seen again. She was not a pretty woman, and she had no inheritance because her mother was dead and her father had remarried and had another family. And so that wasn't what lay ahead for her, and she was very angry that she couldn't get an education.
We'll have to dig further into those journals and ask Kevin Sullivan about his prequel, but I want to begin to bring some more listeners in here, lots that want to speak to Anne of Green Gables. Carrie's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Carrie, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I was first exposed to the Anne of Green Gables story through the movie in my 20s, then went out, immediately bought the entire series, continue to gift it to every girl that I know. And I don't know why I'm emotional. It was such a great book, such a great series. But I'm actually about to have our first baby.
Congratulations.
And we don't, thank you. We don't know the sex, but I'm almost through convincing my husband that if it's a girl, it will be Marilla.
Now, why Marilla and not Anne or Gables?
Well, I always liked Marilla. I always liked her character. She was complicated and ornery and thorny and also, you know, just a great character.
Oh,
and the name is such a classic name.
Yeah, that's great. Carrie, good luck with your childbirth, and we'll be fascinated to hear if you really go ahead with Marilla. Let us know. Let's go to Salt Lake City, Utah, and Stephanie. Stephanie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
I was so excited to turn on the radio and hear your program today because I have loved Anne of Green Gables for decades. And I was introduced when I was probably 12 years old. My mom's friend gave the book to her as a suggestion for me to read it. And I read it, and I could not stop reading it. I read it over and over and over again. I read the entire series. I've read the entire series I don't know how many times.
Did you identify with Anne, or what?
I did. I think the reason I loved it so much is because for me, Anne is kind of a role model. I mean, I was kind of an awkward teenager, I think, like a lot of girls are. And I think seeing how Anne made so many mistakes and at the same time had the ambitions and the goals that she had and the abilities that she had to achieve those goals, for me, was a huge confidence booster. And she played such a huge part as a role model in my life. So I was just grateful that I was introduced to those books because they're inspiring.
Gosh, I hear the passion behind that, and it's wonderful to hear. Let's get one more. Thank you, Stephanie. Let's go to Patricia in Woodstock, Vermont. Patricia, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Hi. Yes, that's Woodstock, Virginia.
Oh, Virginia, excuse me.
I have to give credit to. Anyway, it just brought back wonderful memories. I think I was about 10 years old, and our teacher would read to us right after lunch. We would sit at our little individual desk with our head down to rest. It probably gave her a break, too.
Right.
And she read this to us. Now, I was an only child for 11 years until my sister came, so I could identify with Anne. And I grew up in a small town, so I had wonderful country land to explore. My girlfriends and I, we formed the Adventurers Three, so we got into lots of adventures. And I guess I love that genre of Huck Finn, Penrod, and Sam. All those were read to us.
Mm-hmm.
And I have just put it on my calendar to buy it for Christmas for our 11-year-old granddaughter, Emmy.
So it looks like a century will not be the end of this popularity if you're just getting it now. Patricia, thanks. Kevin Sullivan, there's three women in a row, and not just for themselves, but for their soon-to-be offspring, maybe, and for grandchildren latching on to this. Did you, when you made the movie, did you understand or see yourself as making a kind of feminist or early feminist story come to life in film?
No, I didn't see it as a feminist story. I think there's something, certainly it is, exactly as Professor Rubio has discussed it, but I think what I'm hearing so frequently amongst your listeners is something that I've been listening to for people over the past 20 years. Anne is a wonderful book. It's a multi-generational book that's been passed down from mothers to daughters and family members. And this has also made it withstand the test of time. Our movies have started to fall into a similar pattern. And I've asked myself many times, what is it? It's the quintessential themes about the human condition. It's humor. And it's touching characters, but it deals with all the aspects of growing up, which most people identify with, relationships between parents and children, and in particular, relationships within communities. And the films themselves have become kind of an antidote to the world we live in, partly because they have a style to them and a very potent atmosphere. But as one of your listeners indicated, they'd seen the movie, and movies encourage people often to read the original. The language that Montgomery wrote in may be a little difficult for younger readers to penetrate today, so the films kind of have a power to move an audience on a more visceral level, because movies have a different set of logistics than books. They rely on plot and characterization and visual storytelling and usually superb acting in order to create an impact with an audience, but they often draw an audience back to the original books, and that synergy between book and movie is something that I've watched over the last 20 years unfold. Mm. And I've seen our films go around the world in places actually where the book still is yet to be translated, so that the films in some places are seen in more places around the world than the books. But it's also made, the films have also made people perceive Canada in a very specific way, and that's unusual because it's Montgomery's voice that's constantly coming through, but how people perceive Canada is often interpreted through our library of Anne and Avonlea films.
Mary Henley Rubio, you remind us that Lucy Maud Montgomery came from a prominent family, her grandparents, big there, Scots Presbyterians, and what her family historically, Harpers in the MacDonald clan. I mean, what about that oral tradition and the way it shows up in her writing style? Do you hear it when you read it aloud?
Mm-hmm, you do. She grew up with her grandfather, who was a superb storyteller. They had the village post office in their kitchen, and in the cold winters, people pretty much lived in their kitchen, and all the villagers would come in to the you know, McNeil's kitchen, and grandfather would carry forth with tales. He was the kind of person, as Montgomery's son was, who could tell the same story over and over and over, and every time he told it, you loved hearing it again because it was so well told. And this is something that I attribute, it's something that you find a lot in the Scottish culture. You find it a lot in the maritime culture or any place where the Scottish diaspora has gone. It's a particular style, and it is very much what lies behind her narrative style.
It's something, of course, then there's another kind of communication that gets a big whooping in this book, the sort of gossip tradition of the town where she has Anne growing up, maybe the tradition of her own upbringing. We'll look at that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about Anne of Green Gables at 100, published in 1908. It's centenary this year, the classic tale of the willful red-headed girl growing up and growing out of the Victorian era. Mary Henley Rubio joins us. She's author of the forthcoming biography of Anne's author, Lucy Maud Montgomery. It's called Lucy Maud Montgomery, The Gift of Wings. And Kevin Sullivan is here from Toronto, Canada, director and producer of the 1985 film of the book. Here is a scene in which Anne has to go to the town gossip, Mrs. Lynn, to apologize for an outburst in which she called her fat and clumsy and without a spark of imagination. As you can hear, Anne, never without a spark of mischief, hams it up a little.
Mrs. Lynn, I'm extremely sorry I behaved so terribly. I've disgraced my good friends who've let me stay at Green Gables on trial, even though I'm not a boy. I am wicked and ungrateful, and I deserve to be cast out forever. What you said was true. I am skinny and ugly, and my hair is red. What I said about you was true, too, only I shouldn't have said it. Please, Mrs. Lynde, forgive me. You wouldn't be so cruel as to inflict a lifelong sorrow on a poor orphan. Please, please forgive me.
There, there, child, of course I forgive you. I guess I was a bit hard. And don't worry about your hair. I knew a girl once who had hair every bit as red as yours, but when she grew up, it darkened into a real handsome auburn.
Anne of Green Gables from 1985. She knows she's wicked and ungrateful and deserves to be cast out forever, even though what I said about you was true, she said. Kate's calling from Portsmouth, Rhode Island. Kate, you're on the air. What do you think?
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that my hair is as red as Anne's is, and I like my red, but she hated it. And I have a question, too.
Yes.
It's, why did Anne refuse Gilbert Blythe's offer of friendship, but she really wanted it?
It's a great question, and it brings up the red hair question, which I wanted to ask as well, Kate, and let's deal with it right now. Mary Henley Rubio, what is the deal with red hair in this book? Kate's got it here in 2008, a century later, and no doubt it's beautiful, and she's happy to have it. Why was being redheaded such a big deal in Anne of Green Gables? And, of course, she goes, Kate brings up Gilbert, who insulted Anne about her red hair and then got into this complex relationship. Speak to that as well, if you would. But first, what was it with red hair? What's the problem?
Well, it goes back to the Middle Ages, and people who had red hair were often witches. But it, of course, you know, a lot of Scots do have red hair.
Sure.
But it was something that you tended to people make fun of you in the schoolyard. My maiden name was Henley, and with my red hair, I got the name the Little Red Hen, and. You know, I don't think I ever broke a slate over anybody's head.
As Anne did, right?
Because we didn't have slates, but I got quite annoyed at times. And it just is something that's different for most people. And if you're different, you get teased. And Gilbert teased her because he liked her and he wanted her attention and he knew she would erupt if he teased her. And she broke the slate over his head and was not very quick to forgive.
You hear Kate's question about why. I mean, this is a
why?
Young redhead reading closely and wants to know why was Anna so unyielding with Gilbert?
Oh, he had insulted her, and Anne was a child who felt very deeply, as Montgomery was. Montgomery divided people up into those she liked and those she didn't like, and there was very little in between, and she never changed her mind. And Anne was sort of the same way. She felt very deeply. If she was insulted, she felt the insult so deeply that she wasn't going to forgive. And it took a long time for her to forgive Gilbert for making fun of her red hair.
Kevin Sullivan.
And that's why. Just pride.
Yeah, pride is there. It must have been some kind of extremely homogeneous society, Kevin, if having red hair was enough to make you really the unusual one a century ago in Prince Edward Island.
Well, I think Anne's red hair has been seen as unusual all around the world. People love her for her red hair everywhere else in the world except at home. But I think that pride aspect of Anne's character is the thing that makes her so endearing. She's so outspoken and imaginative and intelligent, but her tender heart prevails, and her wonderful sense of romance as well as a strong sense of justice all make people want to be like Anne. So I understand your listener completely.
Kate, thank you so much for your call. Mary, I wanted to ask you, that here in this little bit we just played, mm-hmm. Anne is saying, I'm skinny and ugly and on, but now it emerges that L.M. Montgomery had this image of Evelyn Nesbit attached to mm-hmm. Anne in her mind. Evelyn Nesbit, chorus dancer, Gibson girl, one of the most famed beauties of the age. So what was what have we learned about the relationship between this image Montgomery had of the great beauty of the time and the sort of skinny girl that she presents in the book?
She only mentions that, I think it's she finds that picture of Evelyn Nesbit when she's living in Norval, and she puts it into her journals then, and she says in the journals this is a picture that she pinned up while she was writing Anne and had her in mind. The picture actually does not show Evelyn Nesbit as being a great beauty. I know she was considered that, and the Stanford White was murdered because of her beauty. But Oh, I lost my train of thought.
Anyone who's read E.L. Doctorow's Ragtime knows that story of Nesbitt.
But I don't think that it was anything other than an image, because Anne herself is completely based psychologically. The psychological origin of Anne is in Ella Montgomery. And at the point that she was writing, that she was starting to cook up Anne of Green Gables, she had a suitor in the person of the Reverend Ewan MacDonald, who had come in as a minister in their community. Mm. Montgomery was terrified because she was stuck there with her grandmother, that she was never going to be able to find a man to marry, and that she was, you know, going to come to a, you know,
tough end there.
Yeah, tough, very tough end, as being somebody's charwoman or something, or a clerk in a store in Charlottetown. And she was very keyed up by the Reverend Ewan MacDonald coming in. He was very handsome. All the unmarried women in the neighboring communities took notice, and there was a great scramble for his attention. And Montgomery is the one who won out. But the point is, she was so excited about this that she goes into her childhood, she reconfigures it, and makes herself into Anne, and that is why, part of why the book is so true and so lively and so full of energy.
And made her name in a hurry, though it didn't come out of nowhere. She had been trying to write her way out of her tough circumstances there for some time. Mm-hmm. I was reading here in a piece by Kate Bullock. She had, in 1905, the year she wrote it, not the year it was published, she noted in the journals you referred to that she had earned $500 from her other writing, which was a substantial sum, I guess, then. And she's quoting here, "The dollars have silenced those who," she wrote about doubting relatives and neighbors, "but I have not forgotten their sneers." This is like her character, and surely there's a temper in here.
Oh, she was, Montgomery was treated rather badly by some of her relatives, and even the ones that she got on well with thought she was a bit silly for her, quote, scribbling. And who could have imagined that living in this little rural community of Cavendish, that she would become a world-famous author? I mean, it just couldn't have been imagined by any of the relatives. I don't blame them. And when her book came out, some of the relatives said, "Oh, that's a story. Anybody could have written that," because they could have. They were all good storytellers. They couldn't have written it, but they could have told stories. And it sounded, they heard the oral tradition in it and thought that. At any rate.
I guess she's got the last laugh here. Let me take a call, if I may, from Worcester, Massachusetts, and Andrea. Andrea, you're on the air.
I just had a quick comment.
Yeah.
When I was really little, I watched the Anne of Green Gables movie with my whole family. It was one of the only movies that we could all watch together, because I have two older brothers, and they're really these tough guys. One's in the Army and one's a powerlifter. And I remember we sat down and we all watched that together. And in the scene when Matthew dies, the Army guy looks over to the powerlifter and started crying. And he was like, "You killed Matthew." I don't know. It didn't make any sense. But I just wanted to add that it really touched everybody in my family. It was really cute.
Even the macho brothers got taken to tears. Kevin Sullivan, how about it? Is it a girl's book, a girl's movie? Andrea's macho brothers were crying at that point.
Well, I think it's a movie for all generations, both male and female. When I was shooting the film, Colleen Dewhurst took me aside and asked me to look at a couple of lines in the book that she felt had been left out of the screenplay. And they had to do with Marilla and Anne's relationship just after Matthew had died. We sat down together and worked out a scene between herself and Megan Follows that would play in the film, that was completely original and just made up on the spot, but derived from the book. I remember shooting three takes of the scene. I used the first take. The performances were so powerful. But the entire crew was so moved that we had to break for lunch immediately. So I've seen that sort of emotional power that your listener is talking about be translated around the world. And in a funny way, it's the ticking clock that has generated all the other films that have followed the sequels to Anne. And we produced almost 100 hours of a series called Avonlea with Disney, produced an animated series with PBS on Anne of Green Gables. And all of that emotion that defines Montgomery that we've interpreted and reinterpreted keeps making its way around the world, and its appeal is as much to men as it is to women. Right now, we're involved in a program with Mark and Craig Kielberger, who run the Free the Children Foundation and whom Oprah has commissioned to build 100 schools in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And our Anne-related educational materials, both from the 130-odd hours of television and movies that we've created, are going to be used to teach students in Africa how to speak English, how to define their social relationships, how to use their imagination. And it's interesting that the sense of community that was so much a part of Montgomery's world, which he wrote so eloquently about, is the one thing that keeps connecting people. Mm. As your listener just described, you know, sitting at home with her macho brothers, and then somebody's crying all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't happen by accident. Montgomery's ability to interpret the world around her, people could be cruel to each other, they could be terribly harsh and outspoken to each other, but there was a strong sense of community, and those delicate interpersonal relationships are the thing that prevails over time.
Mary, how do you see Montgomery's journals that have come out so much later influencing mm-hmm. the way the original book is now understood, and for that matter, influencing the prequels that have been in production in recent years, this more unhappy, more complex life that's revealed in her journals?
Well, I can't comment on the prequels because I haven't seen them.
Soon enough.
But it certainly has changed how people have seen Montgomery. As I said earlier, they thought, oh, she was unhappy in her life, so she must have had some deeper thoughts than, you know, just the kind of bubbly sense that you get from an initial reading of Anne. But I would want to, you know, I think Kevin is very right in that it does appeal to all generations. It appeals to children on the narrative level of simply finding a home and your place and finding kindred spirits. Finding a good friend is so important in childhood. It appeals to teens because of they often feel not understood, as Anne does. They like to think of, you know, imaginative possibility, mm. and they like to think of romance. Mm. It appeals to mature women because there's all of that family relationship. And as Kevin mentioned, the scene between Marilla and Anne at the end where you grow up and you suddenly understand your mother. And you realize that she went through a lot in raising you. And it has appealed to men because of the image of family. And I think probably in the early part of the 20th century, it appealed to people like Stanley Baldwin because of the comfort in the pre-war settings where you have a sense of community,
yeah.
where everything is right.
Before the world in
fell
some
apart.
Serious way fell apart. Let me get one last call, if I may, from Kate in Duxbury, Massachusetts. Kate, our time is short, but we want to hear from you.
I was handed Anne of Green Gables when I was about 11 in, you know, about, you know, 1985 or so. And it opened up this world for me where suddenly the ordinary things were extraordinarily beautiful to me. Looking outside my window, pretending I was Anne, describing a scene in my head, and you know, it was a nice safe place for me to be, especially since at that time, you know, video games were starting to come out, and my brothers were just, you know, enthralled by these beeping, you know, moving things, and it just wasn't for me, and I kind of felt left behind a little bit until I found these books, and suddenly, here I was in this universe that was just extraordinary to me.
And teaching you there how to see the beauty in everything around. Kate, I don't think anybody could say it better. Thank you very much for that
call. That was a wonderful comment.
Yeah. In a nutshell, there it is. No wonder 100 years later, we're still reading and talking about Anne of Green Gables. I want to thank my guest today, Kevin Sullivan, director and producer of the 1985 version, and watch for the prequel, Anne of Green Gables, A New Beginning, coming out. Kevin, thank you very much for joining us from Toronto.
Thank you. If people want to know more about the prequel to Anne of Green Gables, they can find out about it on anneofgreengables.com or sullivanmovies.com.
Great. Thank you. Mary Henley Rubio in Guelph, Canada, author of the forthcoming Lucy Maud Montgomery, The Gift of Wings. Mary, thank you very much for joining us today.
And we have a website at Guelph, too, www.lmmrc.ca.
Got it.
That's the Lucy Maud Montgomery Research Center.
Got it. A century later, we're all on the web. OnPointRadio.org as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.